As we know, millions of American families are struggling financially, and some are facing tough choices about how to pay for college. For students, this means learning to live on a strict budget and trying not to run up too much debt. As part of our series on financial literacy, Money Counts, NPR's Chris Arnold visited a college in Maine.
Students are loading up their lunch trays at the University of New England. The campus is right on the bank of the Saco River, where it empties into the Atlantic Ocean. We met up here with John Langevin, who's an assistant dean and school psychologist.
This really is kind of the picture-perfect New England campus. You know.
I go to work every day at the beach.
The problem is it's like 20 degrees.
It's only 20 degrees, and the water is so cold, but it is a beautiful spot.
Langevin says, like many colleges, it might look like a country club, but behind the scenes, many more young people here are under a lot of financial strain. He sees that as a mental health counselor.
We're seeing a higher percentage of students in counseling services than we ever have before.
Langevin says a National Association of College Counselors has recently come out with a survey, and it shows a change in recent years.
About 70% report that the stress levels are higher and the severity of cases that they're seeing is higher than ever before.
Langevin says going to college always poses challenges for young people, but now there's sometimes the added stress of a parent back home who's lost a job or the family's house has been foreclosed on, and that makes students very aware of how much money they're spending at college.
I think, honestly, it kind of makes you a little boring.
Sydney Kaiser is a student who's majoring in nursing. Her mother's been between jobs and struggling to avoid foreclosure for most of the time that she's been in school. So needless to say, money is very tight.
You know, friends saying, hey, you want to go to the movies after class? You know, want to go out to lunch today? I mean, you know, I'm still watching, you know, everything I spend, so... You become a planner.
But Kaiser says there's a deeper difference between her and some of her fellow students whose families don't have any money problems. She says she has to actually do the math on whether she thinks the money she's borrowing to go to school is really worth it and how long it's going to take her to pay it back.
It definitely puts the pressure on. You know, you stress out. It's not, each test isn't just about a grade. It's about dollars and cents. You know, you pass and, you know, maybe you get a shot at life, you know. It's very intense. No wild and crazy college days. It's, you're thinking about, okay, what career can get me what kind of income and how fast can I get started?
And Kaiser has more classmates than you might think who are in pretty much the same boat. Katie Leary is 20 years old and is also a nursing major.
So I was raised in a single-parent household, and my mom actually just 3 months ago, lost her job. She was laid off, and so obviously that raises some issues with schooling, and both my sister and I were in college, so there's two of us in college. So we have to find a way to make that happen.
Counselors here say sometimes students just disappear and go home when their family runs into financial problems. So the university is trying to do more to help them explore all of their options before they end up dropping out. Danielle Rippage is the president of the University of New England.
We've actually added 4 additional staff people to our financial aid office over the past year and a half because we really saw this increase in students needing more help with it.
Rippage says the school is also expanding the number of work, study, and campus jobs available to students. And the university is doing something else that's kind of unexpected. It's offering free bicycles and Zipcar use to students who don't bring a car to school, and that saves them money. Chris Arnold, NPR News.
There is one group of young Americans facing unique challenges when it comes to money: military veterans fresh from the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. The financial prospects for vets under 30 can be daunting. And for many, it starts with trying to find a job once they leave the service. Elizabeth Fiedler of member station WHYY in Philadelphia reports.
Kevin Miracle has seen a lot. The 30-year-old served 10 years in the Army after enlisting when he was just 17. During that time, he did 2 tours in Iraq and 2 in Afghanistan. Life since he got out in September has not been easy.
When you're over there, you don't realize how bad things have gotten at home. Getting out, finding a job was so difficult.
The former staff sergeant spent 8 hours a day looking for work, but with no offers, felt he'd been demoted to a private in the civilian world.
I literally filled out an application at McDonald's. and they told me I was overqualified. Thank you for your service.
Miracle posted his bio on Craigslist and got a job here at the Philadelphia Veterans Multi-Service and Education Center. As an intake counselor, he helps evaluate the housing and employment needs of vets who are coming into the center for the first time. Miracle's planning to go to college to get a degree in social work so he can help other returning vets. But like many of them, he's limited in what he can do because of an injury. He points to a scar on the palm of his hand.
It was a Coke can with a little IED on an improvised explosive device.
Miracle knows his challenges are not unique, or by far the worst. Kathy Salerno has seen many of them. She's been working with vets at the same center for 18 years. She says many vets like Miracle have a hard time marketing their skills.
What we would like it to equate to is equal to the important role he played in the military in intelligence. But when he came back, what that equated to probably is a high-paid security guard. And it's really sad and disappointing because these people held such vitally important jobs.
Veterans advocates say gaining new skills is key. But in this job market, even vets who seem to do everything right can end up struggling.
I started my job search in November. I've applied to a lot, 50 jobs or maybe more. They actually said I didn't have enough experience.
That's Aaron Lloyd. The 26-year-old Navy vet has an easygoing smile and an accounting degree from Rutgers University. She's maintained her New Jersey apartment with a part-time job and says the discipline she learned as a military policewoman should be appealing to potential employers.
When I was in that job for those 5 years, I mean, the training is unbelievable. I mean, you're at a job 24 hours a day, 365 days a year.
Many potential employers don't understand the valuable experience vets bring to the job, says Tim Embry. He's a legislative associate with the group Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America.
The thing is, a lot of folks don't understand is unemployment's bad for everybody, but it's been much worse for veterans coming home from Iraq and Afghanistan.
Back at Aaron Lloyd's apartment, piles of boxes illustrate her new strategy. She's moving back in with her parents in Florida. Her mom, Jody Miller, has come to help.
She's a great worker, very determined. Military was great for her. I'm just excited to get her back to Florida and get her working.
Lloyd is looking forward to a career in accounting, financial independence, and moving back out of her parents' home. For NPR News, I'm Elizabeth Fiedler in Philadelphia.
And you can find links to job resources for veterans and explore the rest of our series on financial literacy at npr.org. Job seekers across the nation may just be hoping for work, but in Aberdeen, South Dakota, the unemployment rate is about 4%, half the nation's jobless rate. And many employers just can't find the workers they need. Reporter Victoria Wicks has the story on why Aberdeen has to look to neighboring states to hire help.
Aberdeen's current economic surge isn't the first for this town of 26,000 people in northeast South Dakota. The town got its nickname, the Hub City, because 8 railroad lines once radiated from Aberdeen to major markets, hauling homesteaders' harvests. Aberdeen sits about 36 miles from the North Dakota border, surrounded by farmland that supports agriculture, still the area's strongest industry. And because it's the largest town for 200 miles in any direction, it has enjoyed economic growth. But population growth hasn't kept up, and now Mayor Mike Leveson says there are more jobs than there are qualified unemployed workers.
A lot of the people who are unemployed are unemployable, because if they were employable, they'd have a job.
Leveson says when unemployment drops to 4.3%, employers can't find skilled labor. He says many of them are now just looking for workers they can train.
All they're asking is minimum education, good work habits, pass the drug test, show up for work on time, and follow directions.
On Aberdeen's northeast boundary is Industrial Park, a place where utilitarian buildings serve as home to manufacturers and service industries. The 3M plant, with more than 600 employees, has been in this location for 36 years, primarily making face masks. And like other manufacturers, the plant at times has to add employees to ramp up production.
So anytime you happen to have a factor within the country like H1N1 here a couple of years ago, the demand for our products increases significantly.
Becky Jareva is human resources manager here. She's now looking for more workers to help produce a new type of respirator. But it appears 3M has some serious competition for those workers. Earlier this spring, Aberdeen started a national PR campaign to announce the need for workers. Julie Johnson of Absolutely Aberdeen emceed the news conference.
Here's the headline. 1,000-plus jobs in Aberdeen, South Dakota this year.
If employers are going to fill jobs, workers will have to come in from somewhere else. But Mayor Mike Leveson says job seekers who decide to relocate might have trouble finding housing.
The biggest stumbling block is they come here and they look around and they can't find a place to live.
In Aberdeen, it appears that real estate hasn't kept up with other segments of the local economy. A popular spot for morning coffee is the Airport Cafe out east on Highway 12, just south of Industrial Park. Alan Wellman is semi-retired and in the process of turning his construction business over to his sons. They do prep work, laying gravel and digging basements, and he says the construction business is certainly not booming.
It's very slow and it's highly competitive right now, and some of the jobs you just can't even break even on that they're bidding for.
Carter Carlson is president of the Aberdeen Board of Realtors. He thinks a cautious approach to new development has kept the real estate economy steady.
Some communities in the middle part of the last decade, 2005, 2006, when things were great in America, possibly overbuilt a little bit and the contractors and developers got a little too aggressive. Where Aberdeen is a fairly conservative town, we're ag-based. We don't boom, we don't bust, we stay pretty stable.
Carlson says for now things are tight, but developers are planning to build more housing in the next year or two.
So we will be prepared, not if this comes, but when it comes.
Employers seeking new workers might argue that it is already here. And without substantial new housing now, the hub city might just be spinning its wheels. For NPR News, I'm Victoria Wicks.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, we look over the new fall TV lineup and pose the question, why did almost every show with a diverse cast get canceled? Our media critics have the answers. That's in a few minutes. But first, it's time to peek inside the pages of the Washington Post magazine, something we do regularly to find interesting stories about the way we live now. This week's issue is a spring dining guide. Washington Post food critic Tom Sietsema decided to revisit a number of places he had reviewed in the past to see how they're doing. And we figured if you don't live in Washington, D.C. or plan to visit with an expense account, you might think it doesn't matter. But Tom's decision to revisit his reviews got us thinking about how restaurants and patrons are weathering this recession. Maybe it's the Sietsema indicator. And Tom Sietsema is with us now from the studios at the Washington Post. Tom, welcome back. Thanks for joining us.
It's always good to be here. Thank you for having me.
Now, we were thinking about this in part because retail sales figures came out last week. It was a good news, bad news story. You know, on the upside, consumers are opening up their pocketbooks. On the bad news side, gas prices have gone up so much that that's what people are spending their money on. Now, we know that Washington, D.C. is a little bit different in the sense that there's a lot of defense spending and so forth. So not as recession sensitive as other places. But have you seen some broad trends in how restaurants have been adapting to the economic environment?
I have. Well, especially what you find is people who are restaurant goers to begin with are eating a little bit down on the food chain, so to speak. So if they were going out maybe three times a week, maybe now they're going out once or for lunch and a less expensive dinner. I think the chains are really benefiting from all this too, by the way.
Chains? Like what? You mean like Applebee's?
The mid-tier chains. There's a new place that opened up that has multiple branches all over the country. It's called Seasons 52, which it's an Orlando chain that's owned by Darden Restaurants, which has Olive Garden, among other restaurants. But its whole concept is that nothing on the menu is more than 450 calories. And it's at a price point that a lot of people can afford. So it hits sort of two areas, you know, the sense that consumers might want to eat well while they're dining out, to enjoy the experience, to have it taste good, but also fit their pocketbook.
Now, we know that Washington, D.C. is ground zero for the Let's Move campaign by Michelle Obama. But having said that, it doesn't seem like you can walk more than a block or two without running into a new burger place or a pizza place.
Or a cupcake place.
Or a cupcake place.
Or a yogurt place.
That's right. What is that about?
Well, I think it taps into iconic American foods that we all like. Who doesn't like a cupcake, a burger? It's meals often that you can eat on the run. what I see is that people have less time for meals now, too. And at least one restaurateur has told me that what motivates diners is their electronic life. And by that, I mean people might just have a half an hour to go out of the office for a meal. They've got their BlackBerry. They've got their iPhone. They cannot afford to be away for an hour or two for the traditional, you know, three-course lunch anymore.
And so it's partly the pizza and burger thing as a time management issue. But what about, is it an economic issue as well, that perhaps it's a less expensive date than you could say, hey, let's go grab a burger rather than going out for a fancy meal, especially on a first date when you don't know how that's going to go.
Sure. No. I think that's definitely part of it, because people, you know, it's what I was saying earlier about people eating a little bit lower on the food chain, or, you know, people who are already chow hounds, restaurant goers, want to continue eating out, but they're just doing so a little bit less often or at mid-tier or lower places, or doing so at lunch instead. One thing that I haven't noticed is, like, alcoholic drinks are not getting any less expensive. It's still very easy, and this is helping restaurants a lot, it's still very easy to find a $15, $17 cocktail to go with those hamburgers and pizzas we're talking about.
What? Did you say $15 for a cocktail?
Yeah,
obviously,
believe
I haven't
it or
been
not.
Out in a long time.
Yeah, no, no, it's very possible to do that. And, you know, another thing that I find is small plates are here to stay. I don't know about you. I'm getting a little tired of sharing my food, even though it's a professional obligation. And they go by different names. They're small bites or snacks or shareables. And this is a way for restaurants to maintain that check average that they want to have.
Well, I was going to ask you that. Are portion sizes responding to the economy? Is that what the small plate thing is about? And as for the sharing the plate thing, Tom, I'm sorry, I'm one of the guilty ones, because I never like what I order, so I'm always eating other people's food.
You're
sorry.
Always stealing French fries and things like that, huh?
Sorry.
No, that's fine. That's what I do for my job. But it is kind of funny. You know, I think people like a lot of different tastes. And with appetizers, it's easier because, you know, you're sort of committed to an entree. There's the protein, there's the starch, maybe a vegetable, and it's the same bite after bite. And an appetizer is smaller and you have fewer bites, so you want to order more to experience more.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. We're talking with Washington Post food critic Tom Sietsema. He just published his spring dining guide, and we're talking about what trends in restaurants over the past year tell us about how the economy is doing and how restaurants are doing. I don't want to get into all the details of all the restaurants that you reviewed, just because, if you're not in this area or planning to visit, maybe you don't care. But had you noticed any trends with these particular restaurants and whether they were able to make investments? I mean, at the end of the day, most restaurants, it seems to me, are small businesses. Mm-hmm. And are they experiencing the same kinds of things that we're hearing a lot of small businesses complain about, you know, having trouble getting access to credit, things of that sort?
Sure.
What are you hearing?
Well, like I said earlier, like with the luxury restaurants that I went back to in particular, and anything that's away from a big, dense urban center, one of the places that I looked at was a 3-star restaurant with linens and all sorts of wonderful service when it opened up 5 years ago. Like a lot of restaurants, they've taken the tablecloths out. You don't have that dry cleaning bill anymore. And what they're doing is they might still include caviar, but instead of beluga or savruga, it might be steelhead trout roe. You know, so the portions might be a little bit smaller or more abundant, but with less expensive ingredients.
I'm so glad you explained that, because I didn't even know what you were talking about.
Steelhead
trout. And finally, you know, one thing you were talking about is you didn't review any of these in this issue, but in the fall dining guide, you talked about food trucks. Now, this has become a kind of a phenomenon in the streets of Washington, D.C. Tell us a little bit about the food trucks. And is this
huge
coming to other cities, too?
They always say that these food trends sort of originate on the West Coast and are cultivated on the East Coast. And I certainly think that's true. You go to Los Angeles, you go to Portland. Portland has something like 600 different food trucks for a city that's smaller than Washington, D.C. The food truck phenomenon here in Washington is about 2 years old or so. And I think it's fascinating. I mean, it's gone beyond just the cupcakes or pizza to include lobster rolls, which are so good they make you feel like you're eating them on the beach with a seagull flying overhead. It's called the lobster truck, by the way. But these food trucks are also competing for the hearts and stomachs of diners, too, and making a dent in the profit that restaurants are making, at least downtown.
So, Tom, if we do eat together, you will let me keep stealing your French fries?
Absolutely.
Okay. Tom Sietsema is a food critic for The Washington Post. If you'd like to read his piece in its entirety, we hope you will. We'll link to it on our website. Just go to npr.org, click on the Programs tab, then on Tell Me More. And Tom was with us from the studios at The Washington Post. Tom, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.